Okay, and let's give a big hand to our warm-up speaker, Debbie.
Hi everyone, my name is Debbie and I am an alcoholic. You know, I'm very grateful to be a member of Alcoholics and the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and I also consider it to be a privilege. It is a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I grew up in Fresno, California, in a very ugly alcoholic home. My father was an alcoholic from the time I can remember. He's the kind to talk about in the big book, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He was the sweetest dad in the world until about 5 o'clock when he opened up that first quart can. My brothers and my mother and myself endured every kind of abuse that you can imagine, and probably whatever came to your mind when they said that is probably what was happening in our home. From all the outside appearances, it looked like this was a middle-class family with the white picket fence, so to speak, but every night was a living hell. I can remember being about 8 years old, 8 or 9 years old, and my dad coming home from the doctor, and the doctor told him, if you ever drink again, you're going to die. And I remember him going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, coming home and throwing his book across the room and said, those SOBs don't know what they're talking about. And I also remember that he continued to drink, and I couldn't figure out why I wasn't important enough for him to put that quart can down. It wasn't in later when I battled with my own alcoholism that I realized that he just couldn't. They did tell him he was going to die, and I was 20 years old, and he was 43, and he died in my arms with cirrhosis of the liver, with blood coming out of every orifice of his body. And I think I became an alcoholic then, because I learned that I could drink, and I didn't have to feel nothing. And I continued on a path of destruction. I went to prison behind my alcoholism. My alcoholism took me to places like leaving my infant son in an infant carrier in the bar in Fresno in the parking lot and going inside and drinking, leaving him by himself because it was more important for me to go drink. I mean, I knew his dad was coming, my husband at the time, but still, I actually did that. Prison didn't make me realize that I was an alcoholic. In 1996, this young lady right here who was just a baby, I thought it was okay to raise her in the desert of Barstow in a motorhome with no running water and no air conditioning. That's where my alcoholism took me. And I share those things because if you're new, I welcome you, and I want you to know that no matter what you've done, you have a right to be here. You know, you have a right to be the person that you wanted to be and that God intended you to be. So in 1996 when they took her, I got to see her a few days later in the welfare office, and they told me that the people that had her wanted to adopt her. And I remember looking at babies in her eyes and telling her there's no way in hell that's going to happen. I came to Visalia where my stepfather and my mom were, and went to my first meeting at the Atlanta Club in probably October 30th of 1996. And I walked in because my daughter was in the CPS system. I don't personally believe that there's any wrong way to get here. You know, a lot of times you hear you have to do it for yourself, which is true, but we don't always do that when we first get here. You know, and you guys told me I had to do two things. I had to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic, and I had to find a power greater than myself. And those two things were really hard for me. Because as growing up, you know, I don't know about the women here, but like when we're young, we play house or teacher or school with our animals or whatever, and that's what we're going to be when we grow up. My goal was just not to be an alcoholic. And that's what I became. But you guys told me I had to concede my innermost self, so I had a hard time with that. And you also told me I had to find a power greater than myself, which I had a hard time because all through growing up, I went to Catholic school. And I could not believe that there was a God, or if there was, how can he allow those things that my father did to me? The one person, the two people that are supposed to protect children. And so I kind of fought it at first. And I was in a meeting here in Tulare, a different meeting, and there was a gentleman, Jerry D. And I'll never forget it. It stays in my heart daily. He's very much part of my recovery. And I'm not going to say how he said it because the language thing, but he said, if you have hurt the spirit of the people that love you, you effed up. And you're probably an alcoholic. And that's one of the very first things. I had been going to meetings probably for about a month and a half, but I really knew I needed to be there, but still couldn't accept it. You know, and I thought, wow, I hurt my kid's spirit. I hurt my mom because she cried all the time. and I hurt my own spirit. So I thought, well, maybe there's something to this. So, you know, I talk about how God does for us what we can't do for ourselves, and I went to a meeting the next day at noon at the Mall Club, and somebody said, if you don't think you're an alcoholic and you're struggling with that, to go home and look in the mirror, and to look deep in that mirror and see if you can love yourself. And if you can't, you're probably an alcoholic. And you know what? And God did for me, because I took that suggestion, because I didn't feel like you guys could help me. You know, but for whatever reason, I went home and I looked in that mirror, and I looked deep in that mirror, and all I could do was cry, because I hated who I'd become. I hated that all my dreams and goals were by the wayside. I hated what I did to my kids and to my mother. And, but it worked, because I was like, okay, two things, go to meetings, one night hear Jerry, next night hear somebody, and I thought, well, you know, I can do this. It was kind of hard at first, because, I can admit to the judge, because he told me, Ms. Jackson, if you can tell me you're an alcoholic, I'm going to send you to 2 years in prison instead of four. I had no problem telling him. I had no problem, you know. I'll tell you what you want to hear. I had no problem telling the probation officer lady, because she's the one that's going to write the report that goes to the judge. But, you know, I kept showing up, and I kept going to meetings, and I got it. You know, I was able to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I was able to do that step one. The God thing, the higher power thing, I kind of struggled with for a while, but I finally got it. You know, I realized that when I was going to meetings, I wasn't drinking, so there had to be a power greater than myself. If that's you guys, if at times because sometimes I'll be honest with you, I don't always understand my higher power. It can change. You know, sometimes it's you guys. Sometimes it's the women I work with. You know, and I'm open to that today. You know, so I continued my journey of recovery and, you know, became the manager of the Mama Club for a while, and I feel I had good recovery for many years. Somewhere between 7 and 8 years, I stopped doing what you guys taught me. I got complacent. You know, I got invited to go to a speaker meeting in Bakersfield, so I'm like, wow, I must really have this. They want me to go speak. You know? And so I got complacent, and I felt like I didn't need you guys anymore. Even though you guys, in 2000, I had 4 years of sobriety, and my mother died in February, which is, that changed my life forever, but she got to see me clean and sober. Same year, 2000, I graduated from COS in May with honors. You know, those are the kind of things we alcoholics normally drink over, you know, death and good things. And then in November 2000, my best friend Jane died. But you guys carried me through that, and I am forever grateful to you. So I keep going along, and now, you know, it's 2004, and I get complacent, and I stop calling my sponsor as much. I stop sponsoring women. I gave up my secretary position. All the things that we were taught to do here. Get a sponsor, read the book, work the steps, be of service. You know, do secretary meetings or be of some kind of service in those meetings. And our book tells us, this book right here tells us, that we know no defense over the first drink. And I'm living proof of that. Because I wasn't participating in my own sobriety, I got very complacent. I happened to be somewhere where a drink was offered to me, and I took it. And it was like, wow. It's like I felt embarrassed, ashamed, guilty, because my life in 8 years that I had was so good. I worked so hard, you know, and I threw it away in a day. So I stayed out there because my own embarrassment and shame kept me away from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though in the back of my head I knew I could come back, I just figured, why? I'd already screwed it up. And then I'm an alcoholic. And I have other problems. And so I just stayed out there. And I stayed out there for 7 years, and I went back to jail, and I did hurt the spirit of my kids that loved me one more time. My brothers, my own spirit. You know, and it took my son was 21 years old, and he got into recovery, and he had about 4 months, and every day, and I kid you, without fail, that kid asked me, Mom, do you think you want to go to a meeting tomorrow at noon? And I'd say, no, Michael, I got something to do. He said, well, there's a meeting at 7 in the morning, and I'm like, are you kidding, 7 in the morning? I don't even know where I'm going to be at 7 in the morning. But he never gave up. When I tell you, every day, that kid asked me every day. And on May 31st of last year, as he was leaving, as he always did every day, he said, Mom, do you think you want to go to the meeting tomorrow? And I started crying, and I told him, you know, Michael, I think I can do that. And I knew right then that I was done. And that poor kid, he got in his car, drove down the street, called me to make sure he heard what he heard. And he couldn't sleep all night wondering, is mom really going to do this? Is this is another one of those false promises. And on June 1st, he came and picked me up, and we walked arm in arm back into the room with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and like my sponsor told me, you know, I haven't forgot what I learned in those 8 years. You know, I use that in my sobriety today. And it was hard when I first walked in the very first day, but it was like I really never left. You know, even though I was out there for 7 years. In our 24-hour day black book, it talks, and I don't know what day it is, but it talks about us alcoholics having two personalities, the good and the bad. And I so relate to that day, that meeting of that day, because that's my brain and my heart. You know, my brain's the bad personality, and my heart's the good personality. And that book also told me that we're always in conflict with the two. So my brain's telling me to do the bad things, and my heart's knowing what I need to do. But what I have figured out since I've been back is as I do the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which with each step, with each day that I'm sober, that bad personality and that good personality, they're coming closer together. You know, and I can honestly say today I am happy and I have the passion again for sobriety, and my heart and my brain pretty much match each other every day. And that's only because of you guys and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I went to my stepdad, who is my hero, and he's a cop, he's a retired captain of the highway patrol, and I was always the bad daughter, the one that was in courtroom getting get sentenced to prison, and he was always there for me. And this time I went and I made amends to him, and he didn't accept it. He told me he didn't have to. He said he doesn't have to forgive me, and he doesn't. And you know what? It really hurt. But on the flip side of that coin, you guys have taught me, and this book has taught me, that my amends to him was for me. You know, and I'd be lying if I told you it didn't bother me. I was hurt for a few days, but after processing it and talking to my sponsor, it's because he saw where I was in 8 years, you know, and I caused a lot of damage when I caused him a lot of hardship financially and emotionally when I went back out. And, but each day gets better. You know, I've learned that every day that I stay sober, I make those living amends to him and to my kids. And I know he's just probably scared, and that's okay. Because you guys, the ones that have taught me that I got to clean up my side of the street. You know, he did tell me the other day that he feels like he sees something different in me, that today it's about me helping others more than it was before when I was here. And he's right with that. You know, I feel different. I have honestly surrendered to a higher power. I think when I was here before, or I don't think, I know, when I was here before, I kind of hung on to, I didn't give 100% of Debbie's will over to a higher power. I hung on to 2% or whatever. You know, and you guys once again have taught me that I have to surrender. And I have done that today. And I have a lot of good in my life today. And I know, and three of those are sitting right here. You know, and I know that everything good in my life today is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a higher power. And when things start going bad and not going my way and I go astray, I have to take a look at what's going on, and it's usually because I'm in my own will. And I have to stop right then and do that third step and turn my life and care over to God and my understanding, sometimes on a daily basis. You know, because my will sometimes wants me out there doing what I like to do. You know, so I am very, very grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have once again found freedom and peace. You know, we have a saying a lot of times after a meeting, just stay. But for me, I never want to leave. Thank you.
If you take your seat, that would be great. Time to get started with our main speaker. Okay, everybody, give a nice warm round of applause for our main speaker, Mickey from Fresno.
Hello, family. My name is Mickey, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I thank this group for the great hospitality they have shown me and my friends tonight, and also for allowing me to come here and be of service. My primary purpose tonight is to make this program as attractive to the newcomers and new people as the old-timers made it to me when I got here. The old-timer is the most important person in this room, because without them, AA could not go on, and AA would not be available for future generations of alcoholics. There's something, a tradition that I've been doing for a while. Is there a newcomer in the room that would like to have a big book? Is there someone that's not a newcomer that would like to have a big book that has some time? Okay, by any chance, if there is someone here that did not care to speak up, the book will be up here waiting for you at the end of the meeting. I'll start out by thanking Debbie for being our warm-up speaker. And I'd like to take this opportunity to express my deepest gratitude for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, without which I would probably be in a hospital, a jail, an institution, or possibly even dead in my own hand due to untreated alcoholism. The old times were very generous to me, and that's what I intend to give away tonight. So if you're new or fairly new, I'd like to welcome you. And if you're here and you're struggling and you're thinking that life's not fair, keep coming back. It gets worse. And when it gets worse, that's when you're supposed to call it. Talk to your sponsor, talk to your AA friends, and reach out to accommodating yourself. I'm real excited to be here, to Larry, mainly because I didn't create a lot of wreckage here, so I can look you in the eye and face and not worry about having to make amends to you. And I never know what I'm going to talk about. I just say, you know, God, let me say what I need to say, and hopefully that someone will hear what they need to hear. Keep coming back one more day. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, good standing, since March 25th, 1982. Is there any other alcoholics in the room? All right. That's good. I just want to make sure I wasn't one of the black belt Alamon meetings. You guys know why Alamons close their eyes when they make love to an alcoholic? They hate seeing an alcoholic having a good time. And if you're not, if I'm not quite what you expected, all I got to do is remind you that you get what you pay for. Yeah, this is an awesome program. I've enjoyed over the years everything that's come with it, the people that have been there for me, and the people that went out of their way to carry the message to me. I'm supposed to talk about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I don't know why any of you are here. It's none of my business. I only know why I'm here. I'm an alcoholic and an addict through and through. I go, you know, I make promises with the greatest sincerity to my family, to my friends. I can never keep my promises, you know. So I'm extremely grateful that, you know, people were here for me. And I was one of those that was unlovable. But now, you know, I feel like, you know, because of working the steps, working with a sponsor, working the steps in a higher power is the reason that my life changed. what it used to be like, I'm the guy your parents warned you about. He said, he's no good, he's rotten. Don't hang out with him. You know, get away. But you never listened to your parents. So you came out and partied with me anyway. in a gata de vida. We were born to be wild, and we were bad to the bone. And in time, I became a low-bottom alcoholic who fought the law, and the law won. I started drinking when I was 10 years old. I had my first beer, and I didn't even like the taste of it. But in the true progression of this disease, about a year later, I was drinking hard stuff and smoking those crooked cigarettes and sleeping with a 38 five-shot revolver under my pillow. Now, that should give you some kind of hint that growing up, I was not a normal kind of person. There were times that I got productive, you know, and got sober, you know, for a little while, but I could never stay sober. And I continued drinking and drugging. At 13 years old, I had already gotten in trouble with the law. So I could have used this program way back when I was 13 years old. And you're never too old to be too young to be an alcoholic, you know. It's not how much we drank, it's what it did to us and how it affected ourselves and our families and how I became a tornado in their lives. And AA was the turning point for me. And what happened is, you guys ever seen that movie, When a Man Loves a Woman? There's a scene in there where the actor, Andy Garcia, is trying to pick up on the actress, Meg Ryan, in the bar. And it turns out they're really married, so they're just playing, you know, a game for the people in the bar. Well, that's the last bar that I ever drank in. That's where I had my last drink, was in that bar. And what you see in that scene is the bar, the scene of the bar, but if you go down to the end and towards back where the restrooms are, there's a hallway, and at least the back part of the bar where there's some booths. And there's no windows back there, and it's not lit very well. It's back in the corner in the dark, and that's where I used to drink. Well, when I came home to San Francisco, to Fresno, again, another blackout. I didn't even remember how I'd gotten home. But that morning, upon awakening, something changed. And I can't tell you if it was a voice, a feeling, a thought. I don't know exactly what it was, but I just got it that it was over. And I didn't know what that meant or what I was going to do about it. But one thing led to another, and I wound up at the ARC, a rehab center in Fresno. In the ARC, I didn't know what I was expected, what I was supposed to do. And that's the first time I was introduced to the 12 steps and 12 traditions. And I knew that I was an alcoholic. Step one, I always knew that I was an alcoholic. I knew it in my mind, you know, and my intelligence. And I knew that I was an alcoholic. I'd known that for years. The last time I got arrested and I went to jail, when they gave me that phone call, I didn't even take my phone call, so I knew it was just a matter of time before I was going to come back. Because that become pretty much my pattern. I used to tell the guys, when I was the last of my drinking, I was a biker, long hair and motorcycle, black t-shirts and all that. And so I used to tell the guys, if we're going to go out tonight, give me a call by 10 o'clock, because after that I'm going to lock myself down and I'm going to drink to oblivion. So this last time I went to jail, I had no place to go anymore. I was like that, you know, like a squirrel in that, you know, circ cage thing. And so I just had been resolved to the fact that anytime I drank, I was going to jail, and that's the way it's always going to be. So about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, they called my name on the intercom and said, you're kicking out, you know, pack them up, you're kicking out. And I was pissed off. There's no place to go. I mean, I'm just going to come back. It might be a week later or a month later or whatever, but I knew I was coming back. So I was pissed off, and finally, you know, the cook threw me out the back door. And this is how God has always been working in my life when I didn't even know it. I had met some people I parted with, you know, like a few days before, and they called my house and there was no answer. And so they started calling the hospital and the jails, and they found me, and they're the ones that came and got me, you know. But that's the way my higher power has worked many times. I've come across people that I only saw for maybe one time or two times when I was in trouble, and they came. This is the old thing about the kindness of strangers. You know, I survive on the kindness of strangers, even as belligerent and the person, the angry, violent person I was when I was out there. So like I say, step one was never a problem per se, but I had always known it intellectually. And it wasn't until it went from my head to my heart that it actually really was heartfelt. And I believe in chapter 5, which was read here tonight, I think that's what that means, is that we admit it to our innermost self. Innermost self, I believe, is right here. And until that happened, I could not really accept the full measure of the alcoholism and my part of what I was doing, because I was always blaming someone. And so step two, what I've been told and what I've read is that step two, what Bill W. is supposed to thought or his reason for step two was that once a person is sober for a while, and to pick up that first drink, that's the insanity. And so I believe that, and I believe that's true. But I can also be insane sober. You know, that what some of the old timers used to call this thinking would lead me to drinking. That kind of thing. So I do understand that, because I used to go to my sponsor. By the way, my original sponsor was a man named Father Bernie. And I needed Father Bernie. And he was on my list. I had a list of five people I wanted to ask to be my sponsor. And I wanted to ask him, but I knew he was going to turn me down. So I went down the list of the other people, and they actually did turn me down, and Father Bernie did take me on. And what I liked about Father Bernie is that he was at that time, he still is, but he's retired now, a recovering alcoholic. And he knew something about this God thing. And I had flunked God, so I could not afford to flunk God anymore, so I really needed him. And then also, Father Bernie was human, and he would share some of his human traits with me. You see, growing up, I always thought people of the cloth, you know, priests and nuns and people like that, I thought they had some immunity or had something special or different or above more mortals like like ourselves. But he shared with me that he was human, and so he shared his character defects and what he thought of from time to time. And then when I got to I used to talk to him, and I used to tell him about what was going on and what I was thinking in my head and all that. And he used to tell me, I want you to go to a meeting and share about that at the meeting. And I'd say, no, you'll think I'm crazy. And he'd say, you are crazy. So I'd go to the meetings, like the noon meetings, and share in a real, real general way. And I wasted early night meetings, anywhere from 7 to 8:30 meetings. And I'd share a little bit more about it. And if I couldn't get it out of my system, I'd have to wait till the midnight meetings. We used to have midnight meetings back in the 80s. And a lot of them were candlelight. So they would be in the dark, and might be a little candle burning somewhere. And so it was in the dark, so I could tell you what I was really thinking. And so that helped me get it out. Okay. So then I finally got to the third step. And that's the one I balked at. Even when I saw that at the treatment center. Because I've been running away from God. I grew up, you know, and as a kid in a Catholic church and stuff, and my relatives were very religious. And they, at times, they wanted to deliver the message of a spiritual type of life, and I was never home. So I've been running away from God all my life. And that's not uncommon, because even Bill W., when Eddie came to talk to him, or just to see him, and they were all old drinking buddies, Bill really expected for them to be drinking. And then when he found out that Abby wasn't drinking anymore and that God had something to do with him not drinking, Bill balked at that. And so that's where the first step came in, eventually came in to say, because what Abby told Bill, he said, well, generally, basically what he said is find a God of your own understanding, something like that. And I really think that's one of the greatest things that has happened to us in this program and in the step three. Because I think if I had come in here and had to embrace God 100%, I probably would not have made it. So step three, I balked, and I didn't want to. I would rather take an ass whooping than to meet God on God's terms. So when I finally got there and I talked to third step, I talked to a lot of old timers. They basically told me the same thing. So there's no way you're going to get sober if you try to go around this step. You know, you got to go right through it, and you got to surrender, and you got to find your understanding of God, one that you can live on, one that you can trust, and one you can depend on. So with that, I started really thinking, well, why don't I want this God? And fear crept in. And so I started thinking this crazy thing, well, God's been waiting for me all my life. He's just been waiting to catch me in a weak moment. And so once I surrender, I know what He's going to do. He's going to have me on the 10 speed, wearing a blue suit and selling Bibles the rest of my life. And so that was my fear. Somehow, I've talked about insanity. That was, my fear. So, but what I got from those old timers is they told me, when they did, basically all of them said the same thing. Different walks of life, male, female, across the board. They all basically said the same thing to me. And that was that when they had done a complete and thorough third step, they got the freedom. But not only did they get the freedom, that somewhere down the road they got to do exactly what they had always wanted to do, but might not have felt they had the experience, the training, the knowledge, education to do it. And so that's what I held on to, what the old timers told me. And I got in there and I did that step. And so along the road from that, I started running into people, again, the old timers. And there was this lady named Grace Elizabeth. I can never tell my story without talking about this, because this was a big turning point in my life. You've all heard about unconditional love. Well, I got to experience it through this woman. I was going to this group early in my sobriety that I intended to make my home group. And I've been going there for 5-6 months. And one night, it was a candlelight meeting on a Friday night. And this particular night, I got to hear what I've been saying for those 6 months. The vulgarity that had been coming out of my mouth. I spoke in nothing but four-letter words. I'm not talking hope, and I'm not talking love. And so I heard myself. I heard what I really had been saying. The filthy, vulgar things that had been coming, the words had been coming out of my mouth. And I, like, my spirit was convicted. And I couldn't stand myself. I couldn't wait till the meeting was over. So I swore I would never come back to that meeting. So here, months later, this lady was working downtown at the Hilton down in Fresno. And I walked in with I was going to meet a friend there in the coffee shop. And I walked in, and she was coming out of her office, and she saw me, and I didn't even notice her. But when she saw me, she almost like yelled out my name. And there was people there, and I wanted to run out, but by then, people were all looking around, she had gotten their attention. So I just kind of stood there. And it kind of reminds, what happened next kind of reminds you of like one of those slow motion movies. And so you cut to her, and she'd be coming like this. And you cut to me, and every time it go back and forth, like she get bigger, and I get smaller. Okay. And when she got just in front of me, I was able to do a spot 10-step inventory. And I said, whatever she tells you, you've got coming. So just stand here and take it. So she gets up, you know, close to me, and I'm thinking, she's going to be in my face. She's going to tell me all those bad things, and I just got sick of it. So I'm bracing myself, and inside I'm bracing myself. And she walks up to me, and she puts her arms around me. He says, "How have you been? We've missed you." And with that, it took all the last of my fight out of me. That was unconditional love. And when I got here, a product of hell, a product of hospitals, jails, and institutions, and false pride, and ego, and all the things, I could not have admitted to you that that's what I've been looking for all my life. I had this chip on my shoulder because my dad left when I was a year old, and I was out to beat everybody up. Any time that I hurt, I would have to hurt you. I had to make you feel like I was feeling. It was always terrible. And so, once that happened, there was a change, some kind of psychic change occurred in me. And I waited, that was Friday night, so I couldn't wait till Friday night to get back to that same group. I went there and made my amends, and I got in line for some more of those hugs. I was unlovable, and growing up, I know people tried to love me, but I wouldn't let them. You know, I wouldn't let anybody get close. I had scars from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet, and I got burns and scars and bullet holes and everything. You couldn't make me cry when I was out there. But that pain, that emotional pain of what I put people through, when I really got in touch with the fourth step, the last call, the fourth column, my part of that, I felt all the guilt and remorse of what I myself had done. And with that, I couldn't wait to get that out. So I went to the same sponsor, and I shared things and secrets that I thought I would never share with anyone. It was that poison that had been building up in me, that I used drugs and alcohol and other quick fixes to cover up. And so at that point, I knew that this program was working for me. I knew that God had intervened and entered inside me to let me see these things that were necessary for me to admit to get that freedom. And that reminded me, when I was going there, it reminded me of four things that had already happened before. When I was in treatment, there was a lady that had been sober 15 years. And she shared with us that she had relapsed. And that was our first introduction to sobriety. And we could not understand that. Back then we had what was called attack therapy. you could put somebody in front of you and, you know, just, you know, third degree them. And that's what a few of us did. In group with under supervision of a therapist. And we were like, one guy was really irate. And he says, "If your life was so good, how come you drank again?" And he could not let go of that. Okay. Later, I sobered up on the buddy plan. There was a couple other guys in treatment that had got there before I did. So they would kind of tell me what treatment was about and, you know, help me out through that. And so they got out before I did, and they both relapsed. Then I had a roommate. Oh, I'm sorry. I lived in a men's recovery house for 6 months, and I got to see guys go back to their homes, their wives, and their jobs, only to relapse. Some of them only to see some of them relapse and come back. And then when I got out myself, I prayed to have a sober roommate, so I really couldn't afford to relapse. So this roommate was like so into service, and the things that on the outside that I wanted, he reflected. So after we'd been roommates for close to a year, he relapsed. And all those things, what those things did for me is they taught me that if I wanted this program, I was going to really have to work at it. And that's what I did. So I got further into the steps, and now I'm in like a 6 and 7. And the book reminds me that the chief activator of my character defects is self-centered fear. The fear of losing something I already possess or not getting something that I demand. That's what the book says, that I demand stuff. Okay. And I can also be irritable and discontent. And that's how I was, the way I was early in sobriety. One day, I pulled one of these old timers out after a meeting over to the side. I said, "Hey, Tomas." I said, "Since I stopped drinking, I'm no longer going to jail. And since I'm doing a good job at work, my boss gave me a raise. When I get home, even my kids are glad to see me, and they hug me. And the dog wags his tail when he brings me my newspaper. And my wife is so happy. We're having wild, passionate marathon sex." And all that's good, Tomas, but when do the miracles get here? A lot of old timers that had unique stories and have unique stories, and those are the things that help me laugh at myself and laugh with them, you know. And I know that underneath the laughter, there's a lot of pain. It's covering up a lot of pain. I share that from my perspective and the perspective of some of the guys that I've sponsored over the years, and some of the people that have shared what's going on, what's been going on. And because, you know, we hear that alcohol was but a symptom. Sometimes we need to go deeper and further to find out where that came from. So then I got the list, you know, and my sponsor, I don't think my sponsor asked me, he says, you know, when we made this list, and he says, "Are you willing?" And so when I made the list, I said, "Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to make these amends, but I am willing." And so some of the things on my men's list was the IRS. I had owed the IRS thousands of dollars because I've had several occupations and careers. And one of them, I was an operating engineer, and I worked on the Helms Project. I was on that for 5 years, the underground power plant. And I went exempt on taxes because somebody said that we didn't have to pay taxes, no. And so I it sounded good to me, so I didn't pay any taxes. But when I got sober, you know, the IRS had a different idea about that. And so early in sobriety, I was willing to pay that, but I was not making that kind of money anymore. In fact, when I lived in that men's recovery house, I had to take a job at a car wash and hear that song, "Working at the Car Wash." Well, that was me. And so that you know, at one time I would make, like back in the late 70s, I would make like $30,000 a year and take off the rest of the year, and then my company and my union, they would put some money aside, and then, I mean, I lived good, let me put it that way. So once I got sober, I didn't want to go back into that right away, because I told myself, why don't we take a year out of your life and try to get this thing called sobriety? And so I was committed to staying close to the program and the meetings and stuff. And so with that, I decided that I needed to stay with AA, so I wasn't making that money. So I didn't have the money to make those amends, but I was willing. And so I moved around quite a bit in early sobriety. And it seems like I was just like literally like one step ahead of the IRS. Because at that time, they wouldn't forward your mail. You know, if you weren't there and you had moved, they had to go track you down. And so this went on and on, and I just never got the bill. Until I went back to work in my profession, and I landed a fantastic job up in the Bay Area, and I was making fantastic money. And so One day my boss called me aside and he says, I want to show you this. And of course, I already knew about it, so it wasn't any surprise to me. But he almost like wanted permission and asking me if it was okay if I did this. And I told him, yeah, you know, I owe this money. So they put a lien attached to my check, whatever it was. And so they took about a quarter of my pay until that bill was paid off and I could afford it. And I could afford it. So what my sponsor told me, it came true. He said, you don't have to know how to do it, how to make this amends. You just have to be willing. And so I was. And that's what happened. And the other thing about that job is I interviewed for that job and they liked me, you know, and I had not been liked like that ever, you know, in the jobs I'd had before, to the point where they actually asked me when I wanted to start. I could have started the very next day, but I said, I'll need a week. And that's one of the things that has happened to me in this program. You know, the old timers said, you have a chance at life. Take it. Make something with it. And so I did. I have risked a lot of different things, occupations and doing. So I've had like five different occupations. Like, it's like average about every 7 years I change careers. And I enjoyed that. And I got good in my career and I enjoyed it. And then I left, most of the careers I left on a high note and went on to pursue the next one. So as a result of that, I got to do a lot of great things in my life. And some of the things that I got to share about the old timers says they got to do, well, I got to live my dreams. And I got awards and diplomas and this and that from all the footwork. And that's all I'm responsible for, is doing the footwork. And God has blessed me. And I'm not here to talk about material stuff or you know, wealth and things. I'm talking about where self-esteem comes from. It comes from me doing something, sometimes by myself, without involving anyone else, or with not making anyone else do anything for me. The things that the energy that I put out on my own sober. When I was drinking, I used to always say, I'm going to do this. And I'm going to do that. The only thing I did is got drunk and went to jail. So sober, I really, you know, did something with it. I did something with it because the old timers, you know, I talk a lot about the old timers. And I quote a lot of the old timers. And most of those people aren't even around today. And I do that because I was 3 years clean and sober before I ever thanked my sponsor. And all these people that went out of their way, the Ron Keys, the Grace Elizabeth, you know, Father Bernice, and all the people that I've met that have contributed something to my sobriety, all those people I took for granted. And today I try not to do that. So then I got, let's say, the ninth step. I had seven family members die before I ever got sober. And every time somebody died, I'd go take care of the arrangements, then I'd go get plastered. So once I got sober, they were on my amends list, especially my mother. My mother, as you know, most mothers, you know, they love you, and they don't want to see you, they don't raise people like me to be the person that I turned out to be. And she died of another disease, cancer. And I got to see that woman deteriorate before my eyes to the point where she couldn't even, you know, do anything for herself. And the last last couple months, the only way she was staying alive, this would be before hospice and all those things we have today, this is 1976. And so, with all that going on, morphine was basically the only thing that was keeping her, you know, out of pain and alive. But she would read her good book, and she'd fall asleep with it on her lap. And so when this was going on, my wife quit her job to take care of my mother. We bought a hospital bed in. I have two children, and so we put them in one bedroom and we gave my mom their room. And one of the things that I used to do in the morning, and see how God works in my life again, doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. When my wife quit her job, but got totally supported and was glad, you know, that she was willing to do that. My boss, like almost overnight, needed me to work more hours. And I'd have to work overtime. So that money that we weren't getting from her, we were getting through this other way, you know. And so I would go in there, sometimes I have to get up like 4 o'clock in the morning. So I'd go make sure, when I got up in the morning, I'd go in there and check on her, make sure I could, you know, feel her breath and that she was alive. I didn't want my children, you know, to see her, you know, as she had gone in the night. So she was my example. After I'd been sober and looking around for signs about how God had been working in my life, and she became a big one, because even with all of the pain she was in, she didn't have anything bad to say about anyone. You know, she was just loving. And she had told us that she had actually, well, she did, it was documented in the hospital. She died and came back. And she told us, she shared with us that she would never, ever fear dying again. Because she had gone to, she had seen what it was like, and so she didn't fear. So when she went, it was a blessing for her, but it was very painful. And like I said, this is 1976, and that's really when my drinking started. I mean, no, I'm sorry. No, not when it started, that's when it really got worse. Like I say, my dad had left, and so it was just my mom and I. That's the only person that I really connected with in my life. So when she died, I was really devastated, and I drank and drugged behind all that. And under the influence of drugs and alcohol, I almost killed a deputy sheriff. I was under psychiatrist care, so I was just going crazy, and I didn't know what was going on, and they were giving me all these pills, and I was putting alcohol on top of it. So when I was under that, that's when I almost killed that police officer. I had no guilt or remorse whatsoever. The state assigned something like 5 psychiatrists trying to figure out why I would do anything like that. But I'm here to tell you that that's normal behavior for me. Under the influence of drugs and alcohol, I just don't give a damn. And that's not the person that's standing up here tonight. And the people that can best appreciate what you have done for me is my own family. I've got my children and my grandkids. In fact, my granddaughter will be vying for Miss California in June or July in Fresno. Because I really believe, because my wife is a normie, I believe that if this is hereditary, that my children and my grandchildren got that gene. Because they have never shown any signs of disease, and at their age, I was already, you know, it was already full blown. So that's nothing I'm very grateful for, that my children and my grandchildren have never fell into that merciless obsession that some of us have had. And the best news about my granddaughter going to that pageant is that I will be sober, and I will not be the tornado in her life. And I did so much of that when I was drinking, called scenes and did all this stuff, so she can enjoy her life and her day without worrying where I'm going to show up and destruct everything. So the 9-step with my other family members, I went to the grave site, and that's where I made my amends. Years later, I God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, through a friend of a friend, we wound up going sober. Now I'm sober, and I go through on a journey from Indian reservations across the United States. But before I share that, I got to back up and talk about Ron T. Ron T has had polio. He's a sober member, and he was in a lot of, he had some disfigurement, and I think he was one of the most spiritual people you'd ever meet. So we'd go after a meeting, you know, we'd go over to Cedar Lane's over in Fresno, and we'd talk. And then one day he told me, he says, I want you to tell me all the things you would have told your father who left you. So said, I want you to dump all that stuff on me. You know, he says, I want you to treat me like I was your father and say all the rotten things you wanted to say that you never said. So he became like my surrogate father. And we talked and talked, and you know, got past that. So by the time that I got to see my actual father, I didn't want anything from him. Ronti helped me to love my father. So when I did see him, all I wanted to do was set things straight so whenever either one of us died, that we wouldn't have that over us. And I got to do that. And at that, making contact with my dad and him accepting me and loving me, and he had told his wife about me, and I had an open door. I still have an open door. And so that really helped me to have a better idea of my identity, because I had an identity crisis, you know, growing up all my life. And so there again, by doing these steps, one day at a time, I've been healed of a lot of those things, that chip on my shoulder, and the things that alcohol was just a symptom about. Now there's seems to be like three philosophies in AA these days. It's old school, new school, and no school. Old school is when you're really committed to your sobriety. And AA is a way of life. That's old school. New school is when people do the bare minimum to stay sober. And for them, AA is more like a hobby. And no school is when people hope something will rub off without any effort on their part. And those are the ones that say that AA doesn't work. Well, I'm old school. And I make sure the guys I sponsor have a relapse prevention plan. Because it was said here tonight. Remember, we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. And very patient. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Not 6 months from now. Not years from now. I mean right now. Because we are not cured of alcoholism. All we have is a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. And in order for me to have a spiritual condition, I need to work on having a spiritual foundation. Once I have a spiritual foundation, I can expect to have a spiritual awakening. And I must continue working on a personal relationship with a power greater than myself. Because it's not about getting sober. It's about staying sober. There may come a time when I will not have mental defense against that first drink. It will have to come from a power greater than myself. Newcomers, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was Abraham. And so we let go, absolutely. Relapse is not part of the program. It's part of the disease, but it's not part of the program. Now, why would I say such a stupid thing? I have been to a lot of meetings in California and other states, and I've been to a lot of conventions. And I have never seen a group hand out a relapse chip. I have never seen a chip that says, congratulations on your recent relapse. I'm just saying. AA works best if you don't relapse. But if you do relapse, we want you to get back as soon as you can in whatever condition you can. And always remember that Alcoholics Anonymous is like Motel 6. In the meantime, we'll leave the light on for you. So again, I want to thank this group for allowing me to be of service. And I want to thank all of you who showed up, who participated in your own recovery. God bless you.